Tonight we are going to talk about probably one of the main concerns of every philosophy and religion. When philosophers or religious people talk about the aim of human life, they normally say that the aim is to be happy. And I think we can say fairly accurately that most people in humanity are looking for happiness. So this is something that is common to all of us. And paradoxically, our search for happiness many times separates us or produces conflicts. Another paradox with this subject is that even though we all are looking for happiness, we don't seem to agree on what happiness really is. If we look at the different traditions, different philosophers, how they look at happiness, they have very different ideas. So it is a little strange that we all are looking for happiness, and yet we have these different views of what happiness is. Also, we have different ideas about how to be happy. We have different definitions about happiness, different ideas about how we can be happy. If you look into the, for example, the East, the West, if you look into philosophy, science, or religion, the approaches are all very different. I'm not going to be able to go into all the different approaches. That would take the whole talk. And actually, Michelle, my wife, gave a lecture in Living Theosophy compiling all the different approaches, and it's really amazing. So I'm going to take three points of view that I think more or less cover the whole spectrum, and then examine that and see what can we make out of it. So Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, said that happiness is the ultimate aim in life, that thing that you try to get because it is a value in itself, not as a means to something else. So, for example, we may try to get wealth or health or possessions or relationships for the sake of happiness. But we normally don't think of attaining happiness for the sake of something else. So in his view, happiness was the ultimate goal of human life. Now, the way he defined happiness is different from what we normally think of when we talk about happiness. Actually, the Greek word is eudaimonia, which I'm not sure we could really translate as happiness. In his view, or let's say in our view, happiness is a state of mind, or a state of our psyche, our emotions, our mind. It's a state that is impermanent. I may be happy now, and I may be sad later. Happiness is normally related to my relationship with the world. Depending on your view, it may depend on how many things you have, how many relationships, how many opportunities to act and express yourself. But it's something that is in relation to the external world. Now, in the view of the Greek philosophers in general, at least, you know, at the time of Plato, happiness was something that was related more to the goal of a human life. Therefore, you couldn't say, I am happy now, or I wasn't happy yesterday and I will be tomorrow. It is more related, perhaps, to an idea of fulfillment. In their view, to be happy is to be fulfilled, to have a fruitful life, a flowering life, or flourishing life. So happiness depends not on particular states of mind or emotions, but depend on what kind of life you are leading. Therefore, you could say if you have had a happy life up to now, for example, if you feel that your life was meaningful, that your life was useful, was fulfilled in relation to what we human beings should do. So you could say that you are happy only in relation to the long view of your life. And if you want to say, did I have a happy life, you could only say it by the end of your life. So in this view, the idea of happiness is not tied to transitory feelings. It's tied to your value as a human being in the world. And many times, your value depends on actions that may not produce pleasant feelings at the moment. Acts of self-sacrifice and effort and helping others when you could be resting. But if that is meaningful in itself, in the view of Aristotle and other philosophers, that leads to a happy life. You can see that that is different from the view that we have today in general, that a happy life is to have pleasant sensations, to have comfort, and to be at ease. Now, in the East, for example, in Indian philosophy, happiness does not depend on external objects. It does not depend on what you do in the world, but it's an inherent aspect of our nature. In Indian philosophy, and again, there are many different philosophies, I'm talking in general ways, but in Indian philosophy, the idea, there is the word ananda, which means this inner bliss or contentment that is part of our own being. It doesn't depend on anything external. And this is the view that is closer to what I would say the esoteric view that we are going to explore. Now, from this point of view, in order to be happy, you don't need to do something in particular. You don't need to be someone in particular. You don't need to have something in particular. So if this is true, why aren't we happy if that is part of our nature? Now, you see the different views have different challenging aspects. If we think that happiness depends on what I can have, people, jobs, relationships, positions, then I depend on the environment. It is the environment that will make me happy. If I can mold the environment to what I want, to what I like, then I will be happy. The problem is that every person is trying to do the same. And then because the resources in the world are limited, then we cannot be happy. We cannot all be happy. I may want, you know, this piece of land, and there is only one piece of land that maybe another person wants that too, and then we enter in conflict. Or I may want this wife or this friend of this job, and then we have to compete for it. And also the problem with this view is that we depend on the external objects, and the external objects, including people and everything, they are impermanent. You know, things wear out or things finish, end, or change. And even if they don't change, our own likes are impermanent. We may like something in particular, and after a while, we may not like it anymore. So if happiness depends on external objects, it's very difficult to see how we could ever be happy. Now, in the view of the Greek philosophers, there is a little more power on ourselves, because it doesn't depend so much of what the environment is. It depends on what I do with my life. Aristotle would say that a happy life requires virtue, in the sense of, he would say, the aim of anything in the universe is to fulfill its purpose, to the best in the best possible way. So, for example, if you build a piano, you build it to sound good. You don't build it to sound, you know, bad. So the purpose of a piano is to sound good. If you are a musician, you are a musician to be a good musician. So the purpose of a musician is to be virtuous in playing the piano. So the purpose of a human being is to be a good human being, to be virtuous in being human. So in his view, a happy life depends on developing these virtues. It doesn't depend on acquiring things. Now the problem is that still we are in relation to the environment, because what happens if you are a great musician but you just don't have the opportunity to be recognized and to be able to play the piano? Then you are frustrated. So even though it is a little more empowering, it still depends on the environment. Now, in the esoteric view that I said is closer to some Indian philosophy, there is no dependence on the outside. They say, or it is said, happiness is our true nature. But if this is the case, why we are not happy? Let us examine how we come to what we call our consciousness, since we are born. Because maybe the clue is there in how our consciousness is built. When the baby is born, the baby is in a state of unconsciousness. You know, for the most part, the baby is sleeping. And when does the baby wake up? When there is some conflict. There is hunger or pain or some need, some physical need. So consciousness is in a perfect state of bliss, but it's a bliss that is unconscious. Conflict, discomfort, pain awakens consciousness. The baby awakens with this sense of need. And then that sense of need is relieved from the outside, the mother feeding the baby. Once the need is relieved, then the baby goes back to unconsciousness. By going through this cycle once and again, the consciousness that is in a state of bliss but is unconscious begins to be awakened, and little by little the baby recognizes, this is my body because it hurts me, you know, when I'm hungry, and I get the satisfaction when I eat. And little by little this awareness of I am this body is developed. With this body obviously needs things from the outside. The body needs constantly maintenance from the outside. So what we learn as a kid growing up is that the outside is what will fulfill our needs. Now, as our psyche develops, we transfer this same kind of pattern to the psychological level. So our mind and our emotions are also limited. Our moods change. Our thoughts change, and we transfer that idea that what makes me happy is what comes from the outside, and we start having psychological needs. The pleasure is now transforming to joy, let's say, a more psychological component. Pain is transformed into sorrow, and then we get the same pattern. And all our life, we are trying to attain happiness by following that pattern. Now, the idea is that when we get an object, it seems that we do get happier. When we desire an object, we get it, we are happier. So that experience seems to confirm our intuition. Intuition in not in a spiritual sense, but in this sense of this learned behavior. So when we get an object, we get some happiness, and that confirms what we think, how we think things work. Now, why do we get happier when we get an object? Maybe a little story can show in a more graphic way the process. And there is this story of a person that woke up a morning and couldn't find her necklace anywhere. So she started looking around the house. That necklace was very important. It was her mother's, and that was her grandmother's had been. And it was very important, and she started looking around. She couldn't find it, and the more she looked, the more distress she started generating. So for the whole morning, she was, you know, looking in the whole house until she runs across a mirror, and she sees that she had the necklace on her. So suddenly, when she sees that the necklace was never lost, she's so happy. What we can see in this story is that both sorrow and happiness were without any real foundation. The person had the necklace because she thought that she didn't have it. She generated all this sorrow. And when she realized that she had it, then she was happy. But the whole thing was generated by a mental concept. So the idea is that we grow up feeling that objects will make us happy. And then we go after, we generate this state of anxiety where we say, I need this to be happy. And that very anxiety is the one that is producing our unhappiness. So when we get the object, our mind for a little while just rests, says, okay, I got it. And in that resting of the mind, the state of happiness that is behind the mind, so to say, in our true nature, shines. So it is not that the object produced happiness. It is that the object made the mind to stop for a little while, and then what is left is a state of happiness. This is why it is said in the esoteric view that happiness is our true nature. It's when we are... Happiness is not something positive in a sense, not positive in the sense of an acquisition, it's the removal of sorrow. This is why we cannot really agree on what happiness is, because we don't know. We know what sorrow is. So we think that happiness is when sorrow is not there, when boredom is not there, when anxiety is not there. But we don't really know what happiness is because that is our true nature. We can only define something that is not ourselves, something that is an object. What is our true nature, we can put a name. But the truth is that something that is our true nature is not an object that we can acquire. So what we say when we say, I want happiness, we are really saying, I don't want sorrow, boredom, anxiety, all these things. But when all these things are removed, what is left is this natural state that we call happiness. Now, you can see that this is true, at least in some aspects you can see it. When you see how people live, you know that there are some people that have everything that you would think a human being wants. Whatever you think a human being wants, it may be wealth, fame, or knowledge, or whatever it is. And yet, people who are supposed to be, you know, perfectly fine, they are not happy. They go resort to drugs, they resort to all kinds of unhealthy behaviors. You see that many times all these unhealthy behaviors are... The people that fall into this are people who have, on the material plane, everything that they would want to. And to go to an extreme, you see actors or, you know, sport people. And of course, we cannot generalize. This depends on the maturity of the person. But to me, the problem is that as long as we think that we are not happy because we don't have that particular person, car, house, or whatever it is, that keeps us going. Because we think, well, the problem why I'm not happy is because I just don't have that. So I have to work and get that. But these people, that they have gotten everything, and still they are not happy, what do you do? Where do you look? You know, we may be fooled thinking that there is still hope. I'm not happy because I don't have this. Once you have everything and you are not happy, what do you do? And this is actually part of, there is this movie, I think it's called I Am, that is by this, he was a movie director. He had a car accident, and then his view of life changed. And he says in the movie, I bought a nice house, my first house. I was happy. So then I thought, if the house is twice as big, I will be twice as happy. And I bought it, and it was not quite. Then I thought, okay, a bigger house will make me happier. And it didn't work that way. So he started, then he had this car accident and started re-looking at things. He was the director of Bruce Almighty and these, you know, famous movies. But the point is that the idea of happy or the state of happiness depends to a large extent on our mind's interpretation of life. Because you have, for example, it is said that people who are put in a prison in isolation, that is terrible, and that people may even break up psychologically, break down psychologically. Now, you have many examples of people that were put in isolation and attained enlightenment. All these monks that went into isolation and they got enlightened, while another person, you know, gets mad. Or you have people like Mother Teresa that lives in conditions that would make anybody unhappy, and yet she was happy with that. Not that her life was perfect and everything, but this shows you that the actual condition doesn't necessarily imply any particular state of mind or emotion. It depends on your interpretation of the situation. She thought that being in those, you know, very difficult conditions, she was fulfilling her call, her life. She was working for God and for humanity. So happiness depends a lot on how we interpret things. It's a very same fact can make a person happy or unhappy according to the interpretation. So we see that our mind has a lot to do with whether we are happy or not. And the reason is because our mind is the one that blocks the natural happiness. So if we want to attain a state of happiness, the idea is that we need to learn how to attain that state of mind in which the mind doesn't generate problems. The same state that we attain for a few minutes, when we get a particular object that we really desire, and then we are satisfied for a little bit, that same state of mind can be attained through a different way of living. And then we can be happy with no objects. This is a happiness with no objects. There is a happiness that can be independent of the external situations. Now again, happiness doesn't necessarily mean a constant state of pleasure. A state of pleasure is really tiresome. Our body cannot hold a state of pleasure for too long. So pleasure and pain are two poles of a state that is not really related to happiness. Happiness has to do more with this state of contentment that is related to peace, harmony, fulfillment, not to excitement. So when we work to generate pleasure, in particular, we are also, or we are accentuating the aspect of our nature that works at the level of pleasure and pain. So the more we work for pleasure, the more we are victims of the possibility of pain. You know, for example, if there is something and I really, really want it, if I don't have it, I will be really, really sad. The two things are tied. If there is something that I say, yeah, I would like it, but I cannot have it, I may be a little sad. So pleasure and pain, the amount of or the intensity of pleasure that we seek determines the intensity of pain when we cannot get that. So there is a state that is beyond these two poles. There is a state that is a state of contentment, which can handle pleasure and pain in a completely different way. It is impossible not to go through pain or sorrow because of the very constitution of our bodies. It is impossible to go beyond this at the physical level, but it is possible to go beyond this at the psychological level. The more we can touch this nature that we are going to talk about, that is beyond the mind, the more we are beyond the idea of psychological pleasure and pain. So let us see, how can we attain this state of mind? In humanity, we tend to look for shortcuts for everything. So we think that we can be happy by buying things or by repeating some affirmations, or but all these things may help a little. Of course, we need a certain amount of objects, of healthy relationships, etc. We need a certain amount of things around us, but they are not going to make us happy. So beyond the natural needs, we need to learn to break through to something deeper. So the way to break to something deeper, unfortunately, cannot be done by using tricks, you know, by a particular meditation, a particular technique, but anything isolated. It needs a gradual growth into a different kind of life, which is attainable. And again, when we talk about growth, we are talking about something that is step by step, and the next step that we have to take is always attainable. If you think of the happiness of a Buddha or that, of course, seems too far away. But the next step to going in that direction is always within our reach. So if we see at this in this way of an organic growth, we can engage in trying to little by little change our life with no frustration or ambition or impatience. So this is something that I think in the West we fail to realize. We have a spirituality of a technology of spirituality, you know, all a series of techniques. They help to some extent, and in many of my talks I give techniques and all that, but we need to learn how to relate to them. They are means and not ends, and they are means that may help us a little to keep on walking, but isolated, they are not going to help us. They are not going to take us all the way. So the first thing that we said that, let's say, there is our true nature, and this true nature is described in different ways in different traditions, but the idea is that happiness is part of this true nature, also wisdom, peace and compassion. So all these things that we say that we are really looking for, it is said in the esoteric views on what a human being is, it is said that this is all part of our true nature. We don't need to acquire peace, acquire happiness, acquire any of this. The problem is that this nature is trying to express itself through a mind which is conditioned. Our mind can be hurt. We all know that of psychological problems. The mind, just as the body, can be weak or can be unhealthy or can have any kind of problems. It tried to express itself through emotions, which again You know, by mind, I mean the process of thinking, the emotions, the whole thing is our psyche. And then through a body, which again, the body has a lot of limitations, and there are intrinsic limitations to all this. So as long as our awareness is tied to these levels of our being, we are going to be the victims of the limitations of these vehicles of consciousness. You know, our true nature is trying to express through a mind, through emotion, through a body, that are naturally faulty, not good or bad. It's just the nature of things. Because they are limited, they are faulty. Our body, we need to eat things to, and our body can get, you know, sick, and we need a lot of things. So this is the idea, for example, in the Gnostics, when they say that the God that created the physical universe is a flawed God, and therefore humanity is flawed. Because all these vehicles of expression of the true nature in us, whatever that is according to the different traditions, are faulty. Now, right now, we are aware only of these levels of our being. We are not aware of our true nature for the most part. We may have some glimpses here and there. We may not know a lot about the true nature from a theoretical point of view, and that is useful too. But we are not aware of us beyond our mind, our emotions, and our body. So the way to realize not only happiness, but all these other aspects, is to begin to be aware of this true nature. It is like if we were sitting on a chest with gold, but we don't know that there is gold there. As long as I don't know, I'm still poor. I may be a beggar on the street asking for coins when I'm sitting on a chest full of gold. But because I'm not aware of that, the gold doesn't exist to me. So the same with the true nature. All this is part of our nature, but because we are not aware of it, it's like if it didn't exist. So the whole spiritual life, it's a process of trying to get aware of our true nature. Now, the problem is, the first problem we find is that when the mind, emotions, and body are not in a reasonable state of order, of health, it's very difficult to be aware of anything else. You know, if my body really hurts, my attention is focused there. If my body, my emotions, my mind don't have a reasonable degree of order, because I don't think that the mind, emotions, and body will ever be perfect, but they can be good enough. You know, I say perfect because they are limited by nature, so there are certain limitations that are intrinsic. But if this is too, if there is too much disorder, then our awareness cannot see anything else, cannot go beyond. So the first step in the spiritual path is to try to bring order to our mind, emotions, and body. And this is the purpose of the spiritual disciplines, to try to generate little by little positive emotions, positive thoughts, to try to get a good diet, to generate a certain kind of health. And you can see in any spiritual traditions, they have different, you know, approaches to put this in order. And you can follow anything that attracts you or that you feel in tune with. Now, that is the first step. That is not that is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Some people may keep all their life trying to keep on refining and refining and refining. And as I said, in the esoteric view, they can never become perfect. They are flawed by nature. And not with any, you know, I'm not saying with any judgment, just a scientific fact, they are limited. Now, we can get them into a pretty good state of working, and that's good enough. So once we harmonize this, we have to start looking, searching for our true nature. Because all the harmonization is done normally on this same level. For example, how do we try to get our body in better health. Well, we use our mind, we use our willpower, we try to generate a good diet, etc. Same with the emotions. We are using our mind to try to reshape our emotions, or we are using some other strategies, emotional strategies. And same with the thoughts. We are working at the level of the thoughts, trying to change the way we think. So we are still working within what, in theosophy, this is called personality. So, persona, in personality comes from the word persona in Greek, and persona is this mask that the actors used to enact a particular character. So this is our particular mask for our true nature that we have in this life. So this is our personalities through that particular character through which we are trying to express ourselves. Now, what we need to do once there is a certain harmony here is to break through that personality and to start searching for our true nature. That was always the real aim. The real aim was always to search for our true nature. The problem is that if the body, emotions, and mind are not in order, it's very difficult to break through. It's very difficult to go beyond. So, for example, you can feel peace if your mind, emotions, and body are calm. If your emotions are, if you are angry or any other emotion, it's very difficult to feel peace. So our true nature can be found if our mind, emotions, and body begin to work in a more harmonious way. So how do we go beyond and try to search for our true nature? Well, the first thing is to look and see if there is anything beyond all this. We are born and we awaken to the world, as I said with the example of the baby, through our senses. So we are always looking outside. Now, when a person starts a spiritual path or a serious religious path, it begins to look inside. The person begins to look inside, but the problem is that the looking inside, as I said, is normally at the level of the mind, the emotions, and the body. So the third stage, from looking outside, looking inside, the third stage is to try to see if there is anything beyond this. So what is the condition in which you can see something that is not your thoughts, your emotions, and your physical sensations? It is a state of silence. The state of silence is a state in which you can try to perceive something else. When the mind is quiet, you can try to see if what is there. For example, we say, I am my body. Now, if you are put in these, you know, chambers where you cannot feel anything, you know, the sensory deprivation, but in a positive way, and you don't feel your body, even though you don't feel anything, you are still there. If you, in meditation, for example, go to a or get into a state where there are no emotions, there may be no sensations, no emotions, and yet you are still there, present. You may get in meditation also, even if for a few seconds, to a place where there are no thoughts. There is a gap between the process of thinking. So there may be no sensations, emotions, no thoughts, and you don't disappear. You are still there. So who are you? Who is this? What is this presence that is there, even if for a second there are no thoughts, emotions, or sensations? What is this silent presence that remains there? That is what we have to start researching in ourselves. We have to start investigating in ourselves. Who am I? Who am I when all these levels slow down and I persist, I'm still there? Who am I? It is looking in that direction, in the direction of silence, that we may break through and discover what we are beyond our mind, our emotions, and our body. In this very famous Christian mystic treatise, The Cloud of Unknowing, the author, that we don't know who he was pointing in this direction. He said, you have to leave all your thoughts, emotions, sensations behind in a cloud of, behind a cloud of forgetting, he would say. Cloud of forgetting. So forget for the time being about everything, all your emotions, sensations, wishes, desires, prayers, concepts. So the cloud of forgetting. And plunge yourself into what he called the cloud of unknowing. So you are, when you are looking into silence, you are in a state, he says, between two clouds. You are in this state of darkness, of no perception, of no understanding. But it is by going through this that you can get to God. God is how, in Christianity, they would represent the ultimate reality. So let's say the true nature in the esoteric view, the true nature is the same nature as in the divine nature in the universe. And in different traditions, they put it in different ways. But the path is similar, so we don't need to define it. So that the problem in our culture is that silence is always overlooked. We never, as a rule, as a culture, we never look into this silence. Now, if we want to become aware of our true nature and begin to have access to this natural state of peace, happiness, wisdom, compassion, we need to start plunging into this state of silent awareness. You will see as you can get into this state, even if for a few seconds, that when there are no thoughts to trouble you, when there are no emotions, there are no uncomfortable physical sensations, the state that you are in is actually a state of happiness. Or you could call it a state of love or compassion, because at that level, all these things that we put different names are expressions, aspects of the same, just the nature of what we are. So at the beginning, like if you enter a room and if we turn the lights off right now, you won't be able to see anything. And you will say there is nothing there. But if you stay there, after a while, you start perceiving things. You start seeing the people around, the chair. The same happens with silence. At the beginning, we look inside, and you say, what are you talking about? There's nothing there. And most of us get scared, or there is like a natural reaction to the emptiness of no thoughts, emotions, and sensations. So we just get out of that place. We just come back to our thoughts, emotions, sensations. But if you persist, even if you don't find anything, but you persist, you go to this place of silence every day for 5 seconds. Little by little, you start seeing that silence is full of things. And by full of things, I'm not saying that you see objects or entities. I'm saying is full of peace, happiness, wisdom, understanding. Now, at the beginning, you will be able to go to this state of silence only when you put your mind, emotions, and body at rest, like in meditation or prayer. Then when the mind, the emotions, they begin to be active, we lose that state of silence. But if we persist, then the state of silence, little by little, begins to filter down our personality. So that even if the mind is acting, there is always the presence of the silence. There is always in us this presence that even though the mind can react to this or that, you are always touching that silence. So you are not so drawn into the reaction of the mind and the emotions. Eventually, this silence begins to be far stronger than our psychological and physical actions, and this nature begins to be far more conscious in you. So when something happens that upsets the mind will react to things. The emotions will react to things, just like the body. If I hit you, even if you are in the place of silence, if I hit you, the body will respond with the sensation of pain. Now, if you are in a state of harmony, you will notice the sensation of pain, and you may not react to that. You won't hit me back. So the emotions will always feel. If somebody does something that your emotions feel is stupid, they will react. That just as the body will react. If they don't react, that means you are dead. Now, the more you are rooted in this silence, you can see the reaction and not get engaged in that reaction. So the emotions react and do their thing and then just go down, disappear. And the same with the thoughts. So what we are trying to attain is not a constant state of pleasure, which is not possible. We are trying to attain a state of awareness of something that is far deeper in ourselves and that can go and express through the changing mind, the changing emotions, and the changing sensations, and yet remain rooted in its true nature. So this is something that is attainable, not in 1 week, not in 10 easy lessons, but it can be little by little attained. You know, we can begin to be related to our more to silence. Now we have to remember that we have fed our emotions and mind and body and our identification with them for years and years, and if you believe in reincarnations, in reincarnation for lifetimes. So this has a particular energy that will keep on expressing itself. There is a lag time in any spiritual work. You know, this is a scientist in me, sorry, but there is a lag time. So you are working hard and you don't see any change. And this can be a few years. Hopefully, a few years, then you are great. So there is a lag time, although, you know, it may go a little higher. But then at some point there is a kind of breakthrough. And all your efforts now begin to be noticeable. But you have to endure the lag time. That will take a few years. And I say this not to discourage you, but on the contrary, to encourage you. Because when you try to do this, and you work hard for 6 months, for a year, for 2 years, and you don't seem to see much difference, then you will think that something is wrong. But no, every person that went through this, every person experiences the same. There is a lag time. It can be a little longer or shorter for different people, but there is a lag time. I've been working on this for 20 years, and am I up there? No, of course not. But I can feel that there is a change, and it's been 20 years. I'm not saying that it will take you 20 years, but what I'm saying is that we need to learn about these things, that these things grow organically, gradually, and be patient. And of course, we don't have to wait for the final step to see a result. Every little change that we produce will bring a result. At the beginning, as I said, you may not notice them, but then after some time, every little step brings a result. So don't be too, you know, in a rush. Be patient, and you will see that in time, this is a law. It's just I drew this because it's just like in physics. If you do certain things, the result will come. So thousands of people doing these things can attest that if you are patient and you persevere, the result will come. It's a law. It's a natural law. And that's the purpose of talking about time. I know that if I say, come and get enlightened in an hour, well, we have to put TVs outside, you know, because people won't fit here. But that is exploitation of people's, you know, hopes. So that's more or less what I wanted to present tonight. And we can go now into comments and questions. And please, if you see things in a different way, I love to interchange ideas. So feel free to explore this.
So I'm thinking of something that maybe my grandmother said to me a few decades ago, and which at the time I didn't get at all, which is that virtue is its own reward. And it sounds like Aristotle might have been the person who first said that. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's a measure of growth that I get that now. The other thing is, I'm not sure how these things are related, but I saw an article recently about, just like a couple days ago, an article on the web about how children who grow up with any kind of spiritual path are happier. They're healthier, they're less likely to get into trouble, they're, you know. And then the other thing I'm thinking about is 12-step programs being phenomenally successful at treating addiction because they're a spiritual path. If you find a spiritual center, then you can. That's the best treatment there is for addiction. I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but what you've been talking about brought all this up, so mm-hmm. I'm throwing it out there. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, what we have to remember is that when we are so far away from the center, even little things can produce big results. You know, there are some people that have organized meditation exercises in prisons, for example, simple exercises, watching the breathing, and some people report amazing changes. So then you go and practice that meditation, and there is no much change, you know, as these people report to have had. But that is because we are closer to the center. So when we are so far away, any little thing that brings us to the center makes big results. But the more we get to the center, the results are subtle. You know, they are subtler. And we need to keep this in mind too. So for example, a person that is raised in a spiritual way will be happier probably than, you know, people that were raised in other ways. But still, that is not by itself going to solve the problem. What that can bring is a certain amount of harmony in the mind, emotions, and body. Then there is this breakthrough in which we have to go beyond our mind, emotions, and body. And that is something that cannot be done by any external means, education. I mean, of course, talking about this to each other, we learn it, but you need to do it. And it's a movement that is so different from what we normally do that it needs to be something very conscious. You consciously have to start cultivating silence in your life. So I agree with all you said, and I think, but I think all these things are working at the level of harmonizing the personality, which in itself brings a certain level of happiness. Now, in people, if we are in this kind of search, I think, although we are still working on this level, we have to start trying to also access this other dimension and start nourishing, cultivating points of silence in our life.
Just a clarification, when you were talking about the cloud of forgetting and cloud of knowing as related to Christianity. It seems like that's more Gnostic than modern Christianity. Can you just speak to that?
Yeah, it sounds like that, but it's not really. I mean, this is part of, these are writings accepted by the Catholic Church, for example. This, The Cloud of Unknowing, is the name of the book that was written, well, we don't know very well when. I guess what they are saying now is around the 14, 1500s, I think. Look it up. But the idea is that this author was influenced by Neoplatonic thought. Neoplatonism was the Greek philosophy that was at the time of the early Christian church when the Gnostic movement was active too. So there are some similarities, but this is a perfectly acceptable Christian text in the church. And it's very deep. You know, in Christianity, we hardly ever read mystic writings. I had my aunt was a nun, and she was very open-minded, and I had a lot of conversations with her, and I think she was very mature, but they never read mystic writings, and I think that's a problem with Christianity. Now, the Gnostic writings are closer to the mystic writings, but if you read The Cloud of Unknowing or St. John of the Cross or Meister Eckhart, all these mystics are talking exactly about this, with different words, with the Christian, you know, all traditions in one way or the other are pointing out in this direction.
It has been my experience. I've been practicing meditation for several years. It's mainly on dealing with the mind, emotions, and body. It's more like not trying to be silent rather than trying to understand what thoughts coming and passing or even emotions and perceptions. So it's watching what's happening to the thoughts and emotions, feelings and perceptions, that not identify with those, mm-hmm. you know, makes us has tendency to be more drawn to silent rather than trying to be silent. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from that perspective, it's more effective rather than trying to. It's like to understand something, it's better to what I'm, better not misunderstand it. If I don't misunderstand it, understanding always automatically happens. Same way here, if instead of seeking for silence, what is disturbing me, emotions-wise, thoughts-wise, you know, or even body pains during the meditation, that makes it more practical mm-hmm. than fighting for silence. Thank you.
Yes. I agree we cannot get to silence by fighting it. And probably I should give later a talk on silence itself, because this is a whole talk in itself. But at least in my experience, the process that I have experienced, which may be different in different people, to be aware of the thinking was the first step. So we normally have thoughts, and we identify with our thoughts, and we fight the thinking before it even began to develop, and we can never know why this thought is coming. So the thought appears, and we fight it, and we never look and understand what is going on. So there is a first stage where we need to get in touch. We need to develop the ability to watch our thoughts with the intention of understanding what is going on. So this is part of self-knowledge, let's say. Now, after a while, with that practice, it's like we already get the pattern. There is an understanding that we know this thought in particular, maybe for this, or maybe for this, or for this, but there is a moment where we understand that all these things are the same. So there is not so much a need of trying to understand why thoughts happen in this way. There is more the ability to just don't care about thinking. So this awareness, that here I would put self-knowledge, now I would change it for, let's say, self-perception. You are not trying to understand anything. You just watch the thoughts. You don't have the need to understand them. You don't care about them. You just watch the thoughts. From this stage of self-perception comes the possibility of silence, where the thoughts just don't arise. It's not that one is trying to repress them, but there are big gaps of silence. So before, the thoughts here were like, you know, a creek, and then they slow down, and they flow gradually. And then you get to a stage where there are big gaps. So maybe for a minute, there are no thoughts. And then a thought will come, stay a little bit, and disappear, and then again. So there is a growth that we need to go through in this silence. My intention here is to point out in this direction. You know, start looking inside. Start taking some time in your day, not to do, but just to be, you know, with yourself. So yeah, thank you. That's an important aspect, and I'll think of talking about that at some other point.
Happiness and wisdom and compassion and peace, which you're associating with mm-hmm. the true nature. I'm putting still pleasurable connotations on those. So could those be associated with the personality level also? And because I'm thinking that you kind of touched on it where you're talking about the silence. Wouldn't our true nature be like more neutral or just pure awareness or something like that? You know, you get my drift?
Yeah, I get. Yes. The thing is that pleasure is closer to our nature than pain, and that's why we seek pleasure. So all these feelings, or whatever we want to call them, they are closer to pleasure than to pain. When you actually are in a state of silence, you would say that it's a pleasurable state, but not pleasure in the normal sense. It's like a subtler kind of pleasure. In India, they talk about three different kind of pleasures that they use with the, for those who know about this, I mentioned the gunas, tamas, rajas, and sattva. There is a pleasure that is a gross, very, you know, material pleasure. There is the tamasic. Tamas means like darkness, inertia, solidity. There is a pleasure that is excitement, that is rajas, that means activity. But then there is a pleasure that is sattvic. Sattva means like equilibrium or light, or, you know, a spiritual connotation. So it is related to pleasure, but in a different dimension, so to say. So when you actually, for example, if you are in a state of silence, sometimes there comes a feeling of pleasure, let's say, or bliss, that they call it sometimes. But you will see that if you were really in a state of silence, even that feeling is disturbing. You prefer the state of silence to a state that is more related to pleasure, because pleasure still produces a kind of tiredness. So the purer this, or the higher you can touch these feelings, the further away they are from what we normally conceive as pleasure. But we don't have a word for that. We have pain and pleasure. So if we have to say, they are closer to the idea of pleasure than pain. But as you say, you know, I don't know if I would call it neutral. Maybe you could. We really don't have a word for that.
There is a question from someone watching through the internet. My first step is to be aware that I am not in my true nature, and then try to get back to it sooner rather than later. Tools to bring me back are play with the dog, take a long walk, ride my motorcycle, meditation, and I'm back. So instead of spending weeks not happy, it is a few hours. What do you do to bring yourself back to your true nature?
I'm guessing who that was, but I'm not going to say the name. Yes, that's a good example, because we are all different and we have to find what kind of activities bring us back to what, to be in this state of contentment. Walking to me is important. I like walking. I like just sitting in a chair with Michelle there. We have the garden, a very nice backyard, and just sitting there and watching is, to me, is perfectly. Actually, my meditations lately are just sitting on the chair and just watching, and that brings me to a state of silence. But that may not work for other people. Then, just sitting. I think that's what brings me to silence. If I can sit quietly, in a nice environment, that brings me to silence. But walking too, that's a meditative state in me. But some other people may find, I know that Michelle finds that silence in folding clothes. That's her, she always says, that's my meditation, do something. And because that is related, in her mind, is related to a sense of love for the kids, or you are folding the clothes. So anything, we don't need to, to resort to anything that is too complicated. I always mention, I particularly like some aspects of Tibetan Buddhism, so this is not a criticism, but I many times mention that Tibetan Buddhism came to the West with all these weird deities that we have no relation to. And some people are trying to visualize these deities. And unless you are really drawn to this, it's very difficult to get to a sense of silence and peace and contentment with something that doesn't relate to you. Of course, there are many people that are drawn to that, and that is perfectly fine, then that those techniques work with them. Another person may feel that in some other kind of religious tradition. So what is important to me, no technique, in my view, is definitive. There are different ways in which we can come to this state of silence. And that's what we have to find. What is your way to come to be closer to your true nature?
I too just want to say thank you very much for doing your presentation today. My question has to do with something you touched on several times throughout your presentation, which is words and the meaning of words. Have you found in your studies that there is a language or a culture that has more or better words to help express these ideas so that those folks have an easier time attaining these states? Do they exist mm-hmm. today, or mm-hmm. is this something that was just thousands of years ago?
Yeah. Well, my view is probably biased, because in the theosophical view, normally Sanskrit is regarded to be the language of the language of the gods. But early Hebrew and Greek, normally the earlier languages were designed, or at least in the theosophical view, this is the idea, were designed not necessarily to explain the physical plane, but to try to explain, all the dimensions of the universe in the sense of the emotional and mental and spiritual dimensions. Modern languages built around, our, especially in the West, built around our physical world. We want words for the things that we relate to. And because traditionally in our culture, we are not so much in touch with all this. Even the word soul and spirit is confused in our languages, when in other traditions, they have several words for all the different levels of our being. And for us, first in early Christianity, there was spirit, soul, body. Now we come to spirit, soul is the same and body, you know, and we keep narrowing our language when it refers to spiritual matters. So several of these of the theosophical teachers were really fond of Sanskrit. And I know a little of Sanskrit, and I know the richness of Sanskrit, but that is probably the case in several other languages. Even in Pali, I don't know, John probably knows more about, well, he knows more than me in Pali. I don't know anything about Pali, but that's probably a good language too. I will go to, now Sanskrit is a dead language, but it is still used for religious matters. So there are people even writing still in Sanskrit when they write religious matters. The early Hebrew was also supposed to be good, and the early Greek. But then the modern versions also, it is said that they lost some of the... I don't know Chinese. I don't know anything about Chinese and that branch of languages. But it's true what you say. I would say early languages tend to be more richer. Even within the... And then, at least in the realm of philosophy, I don't know spirituality, but I frequently come across the idea that German is far better in many ways for philosophical purposes, that they have a language, I don't know German, but I read this several times, that they seem to have a better language for philosophical matters, and there were great German philosophers, you know, Kant and many others. I know that the Latin languages, they are far richer at the level, at the emotional and aesthetic level. You know, we have many more words for things that relate to that aspect. But English is very fluid and very, you know, malleable, and it adapts itself to many.